You're listening to the podcast of Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Write the Book airs every Monday at 2 on the Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM LP, Burlington, Vermont. The show features interviews with authors, poets, agents, and editors. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with Thomas Christopher Green, whose new novel is If I Forget You. Thomas Christopher Green was born and raised in Worcester, Massachusetts. He lives in Vermont. He has worked in a staple factory, as an oyster shucker, a speechwriter and spokesperson for a presidential campaign, the director of public affairs for two colleges, and as a professor of writing and literature. In 2006, Tom founded the Vermont College of Fine Arts, a top New England arts college, making him the youngest college president in America at that time. If I Forget You is Tom's fifth novel, following the bestseller, The Headmaster's Wife. I interviewed Tom about that book in February 2014. Here's a little information about If I Forget You. 21 years after they were driven apart by circumstances beyond their control, two former lovers have a chance encounter on a Manhattan street. What follows is a tense, suspenseful exploration of the many facets of enduring love. Told from altering points of view, through time, If I Forget You tells the story of Henry Gold, a poet whose rise from poverty embodies the American dream, and Margot Fuller, the daughter of a prominent, wealthy family, and their unlikely star-crossed love affair, complete with the secrets they carry when they find each other for the second time. Written in lyrical prose, If I Forget You is at once a great love story, a novel of marriage, manners, and family, a meditation on the nature of art, a moving elegy to what it means to love and to lose, and how the choices we make can change our lives forever. When I spoke with Thomas Christopher Green, I began by asking him about writing a contemporary love story.
Yeah, writing a contemporary love story has challenges, doesn't it? I mean, I think that I'm interested in love stories, and I like reading them, and I've tried to, I would argue that this is my fifth novel now, that all of them are love stories, mm-hmm. some more explicitly than others, and this one perhaps, most explicitly. But the challenge is, how do you say something new? How do you get a different kind of language that hasn't been done since the time of Shakespeare around this idea? That's the hard part about writing a love story. The good part about it is that, there's a automatic dramatic tension when two people come together, and in this case, when two people reunite, after 21 years.
Right. The other thing that I was struck by was, the story of a reconnection of an old lovers is different now in the Facebook age and in the social media age, and it's so easy to track each other down. And I liked the way that you were able to kind of like hold that off a little bit and not make it so easy for them to come together. Did you find that a particular challenge to try to keep them from just being able to call each other on the phone?
Yeah, or stalk each other on Facebook or something, because people do that. I think that is a challenge. And, but not everybody is on Facebook. Some people are not on Facebook by design. And obviously some people are hiding from their past. And mm-hmm. I think that that's true in this book. So if you are hiding from something that happened a long time ago, you're going to be more difficult to find. Not impossible, yeah, but more difficult. And so I think, that was part of what was happening here. And I just love the idea of people randomly running into each other in a place as big as New York City, which does happen.
Right. And the scene, this is in the very beginning of the book, the scene where they do run into each other involves also a bird that actually flies into a window. And there's just this, like, it's just a very intense scene of just, like, collision.
Yeah, it's a intense scene of collision. And I was actually standing in that very spot that Henry was and watched a bird do exactly that and watched a woman come out of the building and stop and put her hand on the bird's chest. Pigeon, and I was struck in that moment. I was like, I have to put that in there, because I just like the idea of that small amount of stillness with everything else just people moving in chaos that is, you know, a busy part of New York City.
And certainly there wouldn't be a lot of people stopping to see how the bird is doing, and that made her a very unique character also.
It did. It made her stand out.
Now, this is also a book about cultural and socioeconomic identity, wealth and privilege and entitlement, and the choices that we make about how we want to live. And I just, I wondered if that emerged as a theme as you developed your characters, or if you always knew that that would be an important subtext within the narrative.
I knew it would be an important part of the story. It's something that interests me deeply. This idea of sort of upward mobility in America now, what does it mean? We are still very much a country that has a class system. And, you know, it's something that I've been aware of, in my own life, as somebody who grew up sort of middle class, I would guess, or working middle class, in my earlier years, and then going to, you know, elite schools and seeing the kind of difference with how people lived and sort of entering into that world and seeing it with very different eyes, which is very different than my own, the world of sort of extreme wealth and that sort of top 1%, if you will. So I'm interested in that conceptually in terms of class and how it impacts us, and also the sort of, you know, American dream story that in some ways Henry embodies, but also the idea of the American dream is something that is sort of mythical, apocryphal, may perhaps not even exist anymore.
Mm-hmm. I liked Henry's background and the way that you move back and forth in time. You develop Henry and Margot as characters in 1991 and in 2012, and you kind of move back and forth, giving us active storyline as well as backstory sort of woven in. I actually was wondering if you could talk about the structure of the book and how you found that.
You know, the structure came to me relatively easily, which usually isn't the case.
Uh-huh.
But I knew to do this story right, it had to be from both of their points of views. And so the easiest way to do that without people losing track was simply to sort of alternate points of view between Henry and Margot. And then I knew I really had two story threads. I had what happened 21 years ago and what was happening in a contemporary sense. So I used the identifier of the year. So it says Henry 2012, Henry 1991, Margot 2012, Margot 1991, beginning of a chapter to sort of position the reader as to where things are taking place. But then once I started to write it, it really took on an organic feel, a back and forth, and I kind of knew intuitively how long to stay in the present where it began and how long to go back to that older story, and then at what point in which it would sort of move completely to the present, which it does, I think, at the last part of the book. So, sometimes you really search for structure, and sometimes structure grows more comfortably out of the story you're trying to tell, and that was what happened in this case.
Mm-hmm. So this book, like your last novel, The Headmaster's Wife, this book takes place on the campus of an elite school. In this case, it's a college campus, and that was a boarding school, and also New York City. So I wondered if these settings are becoming your signature in a sense, or if you just weren't finished with them.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, there's something about it may be becoming a signature. I never thought I would write about academic places or academic spaces. I was much more interested, particularly in my earlier novels, in rural places and then rural Vermont and also in people who are kind of living outside of what we would think of as society in a direct way, or people had chosen to sort of drop out was my sort of earliest interest in writing fiction. But the fact is that, you know, this is a world I know well, obviously, higher education. This novel is very much set, or part of it is set at the college I went to, just as Headmaster's Wife was set at the boarding school I went to. So I may be pretty much out of material.
You're going to have to go back to school.
Yeah, I had to go back and get another degree or something in order to write a third novel that's academic. And as I say that, the novel I'm working on has has an academic component too. So, you know, there's something about those worlds, I think, though, that are fascinating. And I think with boarding schools, there's a mystery to them, and people were kind of, you know, it's getting behind the sort of gates and understanding what's happening in that insular place. And with a college, it is a little different. But, you know, young people in college, at a particular kind of college, which this is, you know, I think works for this book.
Yeah. Now, at one point, you give us a scene where Margot and a couple of friends that she doesn't even really know that well have stolen her father's boat.
Yeah.
They're planning to take it from the vineyard to Nantucket to a party there. And I don't want to give it all away, but they are drunk and stoned, and it doesn't go well. And the scene shows us so much about who Margot is before she even goes to college. And it also sets up sort of what her parents are dealing with. Which eventually becomes important. And so I wondered if you can talk about using scene to convey backstory and sort of convey who a character is rather than just summarizing, you know, she's a bored, entitled, wealthy teenager.
Right.
You know, that scene was so great.
Yeah,
so.
Thank you. And that was that scene actually I added later. It's funny, that was one of the additions in the revisions to the book. But, you know, I think, and it was actually done somewhat deliberately for that reason, to bring out her sense of character more. But I mean, obviously, you know, the old saying, you can learn more by how people act than what you tell them around what they're doing, the show not tell mantra. But I think in this case, you know, just the circumstances alone, the fact that there is a boat like that to even steal suggests something about someone's life. Most of us don't have boats sitting around like that, and most of us don't have big houses on the vineyard either. And so, you know, there is that sense of, and I knew kids like this when I used to work on Martha's Vineyard in the summers when I was in college, and I knew kids like this who didn't, unlike me, have to have jobs, and you know, Dad had a big boat, and they had these big houses, and they lived these incredibly sort of decadent lives, and their parents just weren't present. You know, that was part of the, I mean, I think that's what you see there, really, is that the parents are, unlike mine, who are around all the time, you know, their parents just kind of let them do whatever they wanted to do. And in some ways, they're both tiny adults, but they're tiny adults with tremendous amounts of money and leisure. And when you're a teenager and that's the case, you tend to get in a lot of trouble.
Yeah, yeah. It was a great scene, and it told us so much about her and her situation. I just thought it was really well done. Let's see. The novel is written in the present tense. Did you play around with that? How did you decide that was the right way to? I find it so interesting, you know, how people find their way into the right tense to tell a story.
Yeah, the present tense. I initially what I was thinking was that the sort of current story, the one happening now, would be in the present tense to create separation from the story in the past.
Uh-huh.
But then I really like the idea of doing the whole thing that way. Because you know, the great thing about the present tense has limitations, but as a writer, but its strength is the kind of immediacy it brings. And I think for most readers, don't think about tense; they just read, you know. And you know, I mean, this is true of me too. I mean, I'll be reading a book and I'll say, "Oh, wait a minute, this is actually a present tense," or and that's different. But in this case, I was really hoping to capture the idea that immediacy in the current and to create that separation, but then I realized it worked equally well for both, and it created kind of a you know, both a mood and a pacing that I liked.
And in a way, neither of them has really left the past behind. Even at the beginning of 2012, they are both very much still living that memory and that regret. So that makes a lot of sense too.
Yeah, that's well put. I agree.
Okay, at one point in the book, Margot meets with her friend Cricket, and this is someone she's known for a very long time. She used to be her closest friend and ally and confidant, and they're still friends, but there's something more superficial that's come into their relationship. And I liked the way you did this. The beginning of each paragraph introduces a new subject that Margot will not discuss with Cricket. So she doesn't tell Cricket she ran into Henry Gold, and then there's a paragraph about what she's feeling and why she wouldn't say that. Then the next one is, she doesn't tell her, she wonders sometimes if Chad, her husband, is having an affair. Then there's a paragraph about that. And then she doesn't tell Cricket that she is painting and this makes her happy. So I loved this. I thought it was so great to present this material in this unusual way. And I wondered if you remember doing it and if you can talk about delivering information maybe in unique ways.
No, you're actually, noticing something that I didn't even know I was doing deliberately. So that's very interesting. I mean, I certainly was trying to get across the idea, and I think I even say this explicitly in that part, and it's almost in the form of a question, but, you have these friends from childhood, like Cricket and Margot were, and where they used to share everything, and now that they're middle-aged women of a certain sort of social status, their whole presentation to each other is about how great things are. And so at some point they've stopped talking in any kind of meaningful way. And I think it says, in Manhattan, in this group, you really, if you want to actually talk to somebody, you spend $300 an hour on a therapist. They both sort of get dressed up to see each other, in almost a courtship kind of way to show the other person how good things are in their world. And that kind of lack of authenticity is one of the things that Margot is really struggling with in this book, in the culture she's in, because she misses that. She misses that idea of that kind of human connection and honesty. And, one of the things she always had with Henry was that.
Right. It's funny. It reminds me a little bit of one of the things that I was saying before was that, we have Facebook in the world now, and that's another way that everybody sort of shows his or her own life to be perfect.
Right. It is. Yeah.
But it's making me realize what you've just said makes me realize it's always sort of been that way. We just have new ways of conveying that. Like college newsletters have always been around, and everybody does that in their college newsletters. Everything's great. This is my CV on what's going on with my wonderful, beautiful, perfect family.
Yes, these are my gorgeous children and all that. Yeah. Always.
Now, Henry is a poet, and at one point we read, he loves wrestling with the words, and he loves playing with structure. Each poem is a tiny puzzle to be solved. I really liked that, and I wondered if you see your work in this way, and I also wondered if you write poetry at all.
I do not write poetry. And in fact, the only poem I've ever written in my life is in this book. And and I'm so embarrassed that some of my poet friends or poets who teach for me at the college are going to read this and be like, oh my God, this is horrible. And I was having this conversation with Matthew Dickman, who's a well-known poet who teaches here. Yeah. I was telling you about this. He said to me, oh, you should have told me. I would have written the poem for you. And you could have given me like a little acknowledgement in the back of the book, and I so wish I had done that because I'm trying to make the case that Henry is a Pulitzer Prize winning poet, not just a poet, but a potential right. Pulitzer Prize winner. So, no, I don't write poetry, but I do approach fiction as a puzzle or a problem to be solved. I mean, it's, a novel has its own architecture. It is basically building an intellectual house, if you will, of story. And, stories have a structure and an arc. And, all of those are, exist for one purpose, which is to, draw in readers, to say something, to compel people to keep reading the story you want to tell. Just as it takes the same sort of skill set to tell a story orally. But I'm very interested in those kind of challenges when I'm faced with a book. And it is a puzzle to be solved. So a lot of Henry's views about writing and the writing process are very similar to my own. And Henry's evolution of becoming a writer is almost identical to my own experience.
Okay. So did you have those early opportunities when you were in school?
Yeah, I mean, I was a college student who I did not know I was going to be a writer. I wasn't one of those people who wanted to be a writer from the time I was 5 years old. I like to read, but I actually thought I would go to college and study political science, and that was initially what I majored in, and, maybe become a lawyer or something. And I was not a very good student. I actually left school for almost 2 years after half of my freshman year. But like Henry, I was an athlete. I went to school. I played basketball, not baseball. But And I was from a industrial New England city, in my case, Worcester, Henry from Providence. You know, I was a non-wealthy kid at a school of wealthy kids. And I had an accent, which I have since mostly gotten rid of through so many years in New York and in Vermont. I had a New England accent then. So I had a lot, and I had teachers who, when I took a creative writing class, pulled me aside, and they're represented almost exactly as they were in real life in some cases in this book, and said, "You can really, you know, do this. You have a gift here." And yeah. And I changed my major, and I suddenly became a good student because I really found what I love. So that part of the book is very autobiographical to me, to my experiences, the becoming of a writer for Henry.
And I was going to ask you about that moment where his teacher tells him he has talent, and he says, "Keep going. If you want to do this, you can do it." So that was an opportunity or a gift that you were given as well. And that is so important. I think that encouragement is so important to budding writers. And I wondered if you've ever given that to another student that, you know, that you can think of. Have you had moments where you really tried to, like, instill that same gift?
Yes, I have. I mean, I try to do that with lots of students here. I mean, just because I feel like all the students are mine, even though I'm not actually teaching anymore in the, in the classroom or the workshop or on the one-on-one teaching level at the college. But you know, in my messaging to students, it is in general one of both encouragement but also realism. That you need to learn to be thick-skinned. You need to learn to trust your own vision. And you need to keep working. There's no substitute for work, and there's no substitute for reading and working. And, you know, the greatest testament to your chance of being successful or as a writer is, you know, your capacity to not give up. Because there is so much incentive to give up all the time. and success doesn't come easy. It takes work. I had 300 short stories rejected when I graduated from my MFA program. And I took the rejections and I covered the refrigerator of my house with them. And I'd look at them whenever I opened the door to grab milk. And it was motivation for me. And it wasn't until, you know, I wrote a novel and this was a long time ago, but I wrote a novel and that book sold very quickly and suddenly I had a literary career. So, you know, all that failure eventually led to success, and you've got to use both in order to be able to do this.
Now, what about the flip side of offering a student encouragement? What is your opinion of a teacher who sees a student as truly just not having it, and should that person say something, or is that just like the wrong thing?
I think it really depends. I mean, I think you have to judge people's work where they are and where they are in their own development as a writer. I mean, I think, you know, when I was in this MFA program, now 20 years ago, as a graduate student, I don't think I was anybody who, among my peers, people thought, oh, he's got, I mean, I think people probably thought I had some talent, but I don't think there's anybody who said, oh, he's going to, you know, publish 5 books and get his work translated around the world, and, you know, he's going to be that writer. There was nobody thinking that. So sometimes it's very hard to assess, because people are in different stages of their development as writers and where they are. So, you know, you can, I mean, my friend Catherine Patterson likes to say you can't teach magic. Right. And I think there is a certain truth to that. You have to be a natural storyteller if you want to be a novelist. And, you know, that part is very hard to teach, is the idea of, you know, that you have something to say and you know how to tell stories. Anybody can learn to write good sentences with enough practice, and anybody can learn to create a structure in paragraphs. But if it's not interesting, then, you know, then people aren't going to like it. But that said, you know, it's very hard to tell with the raw materials that students bring to a workshop who's going to be doing what in 4 or 5 years.
Right. And if they're doing the right thing, they're bringing their really raw material. I mean, they shouldn't be bringing their stuff that it's best. You know, they should be looking for advice on this unfinished product, which probably makes it harder.
Absolutely, and that's one thing I tell people too, as well, is that you're not here to impress. You're not a student here to impress your peers or impress your faculty. They're here really to get better. And that means putting the work on the table that needs the most help, or the ones you're struggling with the most, not the ones that you want to show people and say, look how good I am.
Yeah, although I did that once in a while.
I did too. You know, we're all guilty of it.
Okay, here, I wanted to ask you about your epigraphs. I loved your epigraphs. I always look at these and I'm always like, oh, wow, that was Neruda or whatever. But your epigraphs are, hey, buddy, just write something everyone wants to read, will ya? And that's from Captain Kevin O'Connor, Quincy, Massachusetts Fire Department.
Yeah.
And then the other one is kind of meta. It's Two Roads Diverge in a Wood and We Took the One More Traveled By. And that's Henry Gold. So could talk about that.
Yeah, I mean, the first one is my brother-in-law, and he is a Quincy, Massachusetts fireman, and I was starting this book at my lake house here in Vermont, and he was up visiting, and he asked me what I was working on, and I said, I'm just starting this book, and he just turned to me and he said, hey, buddy, you know, write something everybody wants to read, will you? And I thought, that's sort of brilliant. Like, that is exactly what obviously we're trying to do, and Holy were so easy. You know, so I told him I was going to put it in the book, and I did. And the other epigraph is Henry Gold, the main character, as a poet, you know, rewriting Frost, but also speaking, I think, to the idea of this book. You know, We Took the One More Traveled By. Well, I don't know if they really did or not. Maybe they did initially, because they followed more of the pathways that were laid out for them, which is a theme that interests me. But then obviously they veer from those in significant ways as the book evolves.
Yes, absolutely. This just jumped out at me while I was reading. It's from Margot's perspective. Wealth can give you lots of things, but one thing it often takes from you is family. The wealthy scatter like pollen in the wind, while the poor tend to stay together. And then she goes on to actually question whether or not she thinks this is true.
Yeah.
But it was a statement that really jumped out at me, and I wanted to talk about it.
Well, I think there is a truism to that, you know. You know, I just actually read something recently that separately from, I had already written a book that didn't inform my thinking on this, but it was something about the amount of money you make in America is directly tied to how far away you live from your mother.
Oh my God.
So it's, you know, I think there is something about class in this country that, you know, lower income people tend to stay closer together. And you certainly see that in Vermont, you know, where people stay in communities for a long time. And there's something beautiful about that. And there is something about, you know, the sort of upward mobility of people who are, you know, leaving the state to go to college and then relocating to San Francisco and this kind of thing that people do separate. So I think it is kind of a truism of sort of the class strata in America that, you know, the wealthier you are, the less likely you are to stay close together.
Yeah, I thought it was really interesting. And actually, you know, anecdotally in my own life, I just know people that fall very neatly into each of those sides. So it was just interesting to me. Okay, so what are you writing these days? And can you talk about it?
Yeah, I'm writing a book. It's called I Know Who You Are. And it's going to be published by the same publisher. It's very much in the early stages of development, but it's a, I would say, a domestic thriller with the idea behind it that, you know, we may not know the people we marry as well as we think we do.
Okay, that sounds interesting. Great. And then also, Tom, what have you read lately that you would maybe recommend to listeners?
You know, it's not a new book, but Anne Enright's book, The Forgotten Waltz, I reread recently, and she's an Irish writer. It is just a beautiful, beautiful book. It is so smart. She writes from the point of view of the other woman in an affair. And it's set in Ireland, and she's just a gorgeous, gorgeous writer. So I you can't go wrong by picking up anything she writes. I think she's one of the great contemporary writers, and she's finally getting some of the attention I think she deserves. But fantastic, fantastic novelist.
Okay, that's good. It's funny. I like it when people mention older books because I feel like books should live forever, and I like to hear about the ones that maybe got away and I didn't know about them at the time. So I think we may have discussed this in our last interview, but I want to talk about it again in at least these last two books. You've written from a female as well as from a male point of view. Mm-hmm. And I just wonder if you can talk a little bit about writing Margot and how that went for you. And do you have female readers who will give you feedback?
I do have female readers, starting with my editor, who will give me feedback. For me, there are challenges from writing from a female point of view, obviously. But on the other hand, you could say women and men are so different, et cetera. In some cases, we're very much the same. But I do have a lot of female friends. I try to listen. I try to understand where they're coming from, and also in the relationships I've been in as a person, and try to put myself in the other person's shoes and see how they think or feel or what they value or what's important to them. And so, I hope I get it right. I hope it becomes believable off my pen onto the page to see the world through the eyes of a woman. And I have done it, as you said, with both Headmaster's Wife and with this book. I may do it exclusively with my new book, so I don't know. That feels a little riskier. The one place I don't go with it or haven't been comfortable going with it yet is doing it from a first-person point of view. So It's always third-person, and so that does give you the kind of range, if you will, as a writer to... to elucidate somebody's thoughts without actually fully becoming or inhabiting them in the same way you do in a first person.
Have you written first person in a male point of view?
Yes. I mean, the first...
Do you like that?
I do. I like... There's advantages to first person and there's disadvantages. So Headmaster's Wife, the first section, is first person from the headmaster's point of view. And I've done it also. Envious Moon, my third book, is entirely first person point of view from a probably 18-year-old male. But it's the beauty of first person is as a very natural storytelling style, and it's the way people expect to hear a story told. So in some ways it's easier to grip a reader in a first person narration. It also gives you a greater sort of narrative perspective or ability to tell the story in a certain way, because I am telling you a story of something that happened to me. So, you're almost automatically on top of the story rather than trying to just dive right in. So you get that benefit of the telling part of it, which is underutilized in fiction often because we're told not to tell, but first person is a telling, call me Ishmael or, this is what happened to me, is basically what you were saying in first person. The downside of it comes through language, because you should have a first-person narration where the voice of the character, kind of defines who the character is. And Catcher in the Rye would be a great example of that. But that can also be limiting, because what is the person's educational attainment level? What do they do? What can they say? Was this a word they would actually use? Whereas if you write in the third person, and you can be more musical, more lyrical, you can do more things with language, you have more freedom in third person than you do in first. So it both has great benefits, and like anything else in fiction, it's also can be very limiting.
Great. That was a wonderful summary of a lot of important points about that. And I think it's really hard sometimes to find which person to write in to best convey your story. And either one can have, as you say, benefits and drawbacks. So thanks. Okay, so when I was a student at Vermont College, I attended a great lecture by Brett Lott, the author, Brett Lott, who's on the was on the faculty at that time. And one aspect of his talk had to do with the fact that many of his students would tell him that they avoided writing anything emotional or, you know, remotely sentimental for fear of being cheesy. That was the word that they would always use. I don't want to be cheesy. Yeah. So, you know, what I took from his talk was, you know, don't avoid, his point at the end was don't avoid writing about real emotions because they are sometimes overdone by lesser writers, okay? And as I read your book, which was not at all cheesy, it was very beautiful and well done, I wondered, though, if you had to table any insecurity about writing a love story, because, of course, it's full of emotion.
Yeah, you've got to be careful not to veer too much into either sentimentality or romance, and that is the hard part if you're trying, you know, to write serious fiction or things that you feel are important, to not... You know, there are traps everywhere in that when you're doing a love story and a set of expectations that come with it. And yet there is a lot of raw emotion in this book on both sides that are, you know, articulated. So I think that is, you know, that is something that, you know, I don't know that I would have done as well. I don't think I could have written this book 25 years ago. Close to it. I don't think I had both the knowledge, the life experience, or the skill set as a writer to be able to thread that needle, as it were. And I hope I did it. Some people will obviously disagree, but some readers will disagree.
Well, they're wrong.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. I take your definitive remarks and accept them. Some people may disagree, but carving that, threading that needle. You know, took a level of skill that I didn't have when I began my writing career.
What about courage? Do you think it takes a little bit of courage to write something? I'm not saying that you should pat yourself on the back, but I'm just curious, like if you were giving advice to a student, do you think that it's harder to write certain kinds of books because we're afraid?
Well, I think one of the benefits of getting older is that we become more honest. And I think if it left as courage as in more as honesty. Because I think we are afraid to put ourselves out there in a way that says, oh, yeah, this is really what I think or what I feel, or this is what this looks like. And I think, you know, I have seen a kind of quantum growth in my literary career in my last two books. You know, I mean, I published three novels before Headmaster's Wife. They were all major houses. They got very good reviews. They came out and didn't get a lot of attention. Headmaster's Wife got a ton of attention. This book is too. And I think part of it is a function of the level of honesty that I am bringing to the page and that people are responding to and feeling. That's taken me a long time to figure that out. It's not courage, yes, you know, courage to create, courage to put yourself out there, sure. But for me, it's really about you know, being honest on the page and just not really caring what people think, and they either relate or identify to it or they don't.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I have just one last question for you. This is going to seem like a kind of small question for advice for listeners, but I think it's important, and I don't think I've ever asked it before. So anyway, in one scene, Henry is invited to read his work in front of a large audience at his college, and he's reading in advance of a very famous poet who's the main event. And you describe his nerves and the warm and thick air, and you write, Henry is happy for the podium, this small wall between him and them, and his hands shake as he lays the paper down, and he can feel the muscles in his legs contracting and flexing as if his knees have been tapped with a rubber mallet. I thought this was a great description of what that moment can feel like. It was really good. But I just wondered if you have any advice for reading, for listeners who maybe are going to be doing a first reading soon and they don't, you know how it's going to go.
Yeah, I think really slow down. I mean, see the words as individual pieces. And I think that's actually the advice the poet gives Henry. Is to pick out each word and to see each word that you're reading as an individual thing, in addition to being part of a sentence. And, you know, I'm actually someone who's not a huge fan of readings. I don't like listening to other people read particularly. I'd rather read a book myself. Obviously, I go to a fair amount of readings because I'm the president of a fine arts college where we have those.
You may be a little burned out.
A little burned out, but I just, you know, occasionally you come across somebody who, you know, you really get sucked into the words and the story, but oftentimes I find it's not the experience of reading a book. It's very different. So, but I think public speaking in general is the bigger question here, and I think that as someone who has to do a whole lot of this and used to be uncomfortable with it, and now I do tons of it and tell stories and do all this stuff, and I've been doing it for a long time, is the fact is, and I think this may be in the book too as well, but audiences are enormously generous. Mm-hmm. And someone once told me the best advice I got is that, you know, no one's thinking about you, Tom, when you're up there. They're only thinking about themselves.
Oh, wow.
And I think that is fundamentally true. And so when you get up there, you're not being judged by people. Instead, they are thinking, how is this going to entertain me? And there is a group mentality, particularly around humor with an audience, where if I were to tell you something that was sort of funny, might be very, very funny in front of 500 people. So it's, I think for readers, for speakers, for people who are doing things in a public way, it's all going to be okay if you just be yourself, talk like you would normally talk if you were telling a story to one or two people instead of to 500.
Okay, great. So I want to once again mention that the book is titled If I Forget You, a novel by Thomas Christopher Green, and it's published by Thomas Dunn Books, an imprint of St. Martin's Press. Thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That, again, was a conversation with Thomas Christopher Green. You can learn more about his work at his website, thomaschristophergreen.com. This week's Write the Book prompt is to write a love scene. Allow yourself to express emotion, and don't mistake sentiment for sentimentality. Good luck with this prompt, and please listen next week for another. Write the Book and The Radiator are supported in part by The Farmhouse, Burlington's farm-to-table gastropub serving award-winning burgers, innovative entrees, and a world-class craft beer menu, and by Main Street Landing, providing daily rental space for events, meetings, conferences, and parties. Visit mainstreetlanding.com for more information, or come on down to the Burlington waterfront. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know they can stream it live at theradiator.org every Monday from 2 to 3. Archived episodes of Write the Book are also available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and Write the Book Radio Show on Facebook for updates. And you can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. My co-host Gary's website is garyleemiller.com. If you have a guest to suggest or comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. Please remember that The Radiator exists thanks to community support and involvement. More information about The Radiator is available online at bigheavyworld.com. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro, and you've been listening to Write the Book, which airs Mondays at 2 on The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM LP, Burlington, Vermont.